Ranked number one in innovation 10 consecutive years, Arizona State University isn't just ahead of the curve. It's creating new paths to success. Learn from notable clinical and research faculty. Online, that's a degree better. Explore programs at asuonline.asu.edu. At Arizona State University, we're bringing world-class education from our globally acclaimed faculty to you. Ranked number one in innovation for 10 consecutive years, and number two among public universities for employability, ASU isn't just ahead of the curve. It's creating new paths to success. Earn your degree from the nation's most innovative university. Online, that's a degree better. Explore more than 300 undergraduate, graduate, and certificate programs at asuonline.asu.edu.
Hey, folks, welcome back to another episode of the Ruby Rogues podcast. This week on our panel, we have Ayush Nuwatia.
Hello, hello.
I'm Charles Maxwood from Top End Devs. And this week we have a special guest. It is Joe Mazzalotti. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
Doing all right. I think we had you a while back talking about then Turbo Native, now Hotwire Native. What's new?
Yeah. So I am writing a book on Hotwire Native, and it is coming very close to it being completely done. So getting the word out, talking about Hotwire Native, and just getting more and more Rails developers to use it. It's been a fun couple months, for sure.
All right. The book is out, right?
Yeah, so the book is out. You can buy it digital only right now as we finish up the last chapter. And then when it comes out, you know, final version, you can start ordering the physical copies and like get it at your bookstore and stuff. But if you buy it now, you get a discount and then you get an update email every 2 weeks with like the new features and everything that have been added to the book. So if you're only going digital, it makes sense to buy it now for the discount. But if you want to wait for physical, wait till, you know, a few more months.
Right. And that's, so is it only available on the Pragmatic bookshelf?
Yeah. Then? Yeah. It's only available directly from my publisher.
Awesome. And those guys are amazing. I love those guys.
It has been such a pleasure working with them. Oh my God. Even just from like the initial calls with them, I had such a good feeling about them as a publisher versus everyone else I spoke to. And oof, looking back on it, so glad I went with a publisher instead of self-publishing, because I probably would have given up by now, to be honest.
Yeah.
So, you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. That was one of the questions I was going to dig into, is publisher versus no publisher. We'll get to that a bit later on.
Yeah, in the chat. For sure.
We could just do it now. I was going to say, I mean, I've self-published a book. I know I used to self-publish a book. I've talked to the guys at Pragmatic Bookshelf before, but I've never actually gone all the way to, hey, maybe we should do a book together. Mm-hmm. But I know a lot of folks over there, I don't know who you're working with, but over there is your editor and stuff. But yeah, it's way back in the day, Ruby Rogues was going to write a book. Mm-hmm. And we were talking to Pearson O'Reilly kind of folks. And the reason was because we were going to piggyback on Smalltalk best practice patterns to write Ruby best practice patterns. Nice. And so since we were kind of stealing the book title a little bit, you know, borrowing, we figured we'd have less legal trouble. But there were six of us at the time, and they wanted to give us like a 10 or 15% royalty to split among the six of us. And we kind of did all the looking and feeling and everything. And I mean, they had a clamp down ownership, blah, 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 blah. And the royalty was awful. And then I talked to people who have published through Pragmatic Bookshelf, and they're like, oh, these guys are a dream. And, you know, they're totally willing to work with you as far as like ownership rights. I know some people have let them own it and other people have kept ownership. I've seen it work both ways. They've also published books like Avdi Grimm's Exceptional Ruby. He self-published it and then they picked it up. Yeah. And so, you know, and so they're totally willing to play ball. And they're, everybody that I've talked to, the royalty rate's like 40 or 50%.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And we could talk about it more, but like, if they were giving me 0% royalties, I still would have went with them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Perhaps a little, you know, insider knowledge here. I'm not planning on making money off of the book. It's not my goal to make money. Like I did the math on it. However many Rails developers there are in the world, however many of those are going to do mobile apps, it's still a relatively niche topic, right? Maybe that changes in a few years and I'm singing a different tune. But right now, if I can get one or like two high ticket clients for my consulting business from this book, it will pay for itself. Like all the work that I put into it. Like that's all I need is to land two big clients. And that's my kind of marketing plan with all of it. Like when I go to conferences, I'm checking a suitcase full of books to bring with me to just throw into the crowd, essentially. You know, like I want to get this thing to as many people as possible. So having a publisher that supports really good distribution and getting into local bookstores and a kick-ass editor, like it worked. It worked so well. The 40-50% royalties is kind of just a bonus to me.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up because it seems like the only people I really see make any kind of real money on books are essentially celebrities, right? Mm-hmm. So you hear that like Michelle Obama got a gazillion dollar, and it wasn't royalties, it was an advance on royalties for the book. And it was because the publishing house knew they could sell a whole bunch of those books and they liked her. And so they figured it out. Whereas, yeah, you know, for us, we're in a small niche. And in your case, it's a small niche of a small niche. And so, yeah, you know, you're doing it for reputational and other reasons that make a lot of sense.
Exactly.
So yeah, the market,
it's not going to be a New York Times bestseller, and I'm okay with that.
I'm disappointed. It should be.
I mean, that'd be wild if it was, but I don't see that happening anytime soon.
Everybody's doing Hotwire Native these days.
Yeah. Hopefully, the broader New York Times audience is also doing Hotwire Native, and they'll understand what I'm talking about. But not this year. Maybe the second edition.
Yeah, well, you know, we are in the Rails Renaissance, is what I'm hearing. So, let's move in and talk about Hotwire Native, because I think that's probably where most people want to hear about. I think the book Insider Baseball is helpful for the people who may want to write a book, or you know, maybe they're like, oh, this publisher does a good job on these things and takes good care of their authors, and so I want to support them. But yeah, let's dive in. So Hotwire Native, we've already done a show on Turbo Native, and I don't think the overall thing that it does is changed. So just give us a real quick overview on that. And then what I'd like to do is get into what's changed.
Sure.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. So Hotwire Native takes your mobile website and shoves it inside of an app that you download from the App Store or Google Play. So your app itself, the code is essentially a web browser that has, you know, maybe a native tab bar, native navigation, push notifications, stuff like that. But the majority of the content is a web view hitting your server, probably your Rails server, and rendering your HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And what it gives you is like almost full feature parity with your Rails app with just a few lines of native code. And once you submit to the app stores, you can continue to add new features to your Rails app. And because the native clients are just hitting your server, they get those features essentially for free, as long as there's a link to that new feature on an existing page. That's been the story for a decade since like TurboLinks Native was around. And there's also opportunity to dive down into native APIs. It's different than like React Native, where it's taking over the entire app and you have to write React Native. Hotwire Native sits next to iOS or Android. And when you want to drop down to, you know, push notification API or the haptics feedback or HealthKit, you just write that code and then send some data back to your server or back to the web view. There's no HealthKit plugin for Hotwire Native. You just write HealthKit code, so to speak.
Right. And I think, yeah, it's a little bit like, oh, go ahead.
I think one key point that also needs to be made is it's separate code bases for iOS and Android, which I'm a huge fan of, because I don't believe the one code base across many platforms thing has ever worked. So I really like the fact that you have two separate code bases, which kind of share this common engine of the Rails app.
Yeah, for sure.
I'll say haven't done.
The two code bases are essentially wrappers, right? Like there's, until you go into real native implementations of things, the code length in the native apps is relatively minimal.
Yeah, I've done some Turbo, or no, not Turbo Native. I've done some React Native, and I mean, they tried to sell you on the one code base for everything, but I think eventually they just had to acknowledge that sometimes you're just going to have to deviate and have this for this and that for that. But yeah, it's like a full takeover on the JavaScript. You're building the interface and the whole nine yards. And what I've seen and done with something like Hotwired Native, the nice thing is I can keep the same look and feel if I want people to have the same experience on the web and on the app. Or I've also seen it where people tend, you know, they kind of pick up a style sheet and kind of figure it out so that it looks more native.
Ranked number one in innovation 10 consecutive years, Arizona State University isn't just ahead of the curve. It's creating new paths to success. Learn from notable clinical and research faculty online. That's a degree better. Explore programs at asuonline.asu.edu. At Arizona State University, we're bringing world-class education from our globally acclaimed faculty to you. Ranked number one in innovation for 10 consecutive years and number two among public universities for employability, ASU isn't just ahead of the curve. It's creating new paths to success. Earn your degree from the nation's most innovative university. Online, that's a degree better. Explore more than 300 undergraduate, graduate, and certificate programs at asuonline.asu.edu.
If you're in the app, you get a lot of mileage out of it that way.
Yeah, you get a lot. And one of the big recommendations I have is to continue using your web design in the apps. Like if you're trying to chase iOS, like iOS native UI and Android native UI, you're always just playing catch up. So doing your Tailwind CSS or your Twitter Bootstrap, you know, styling on the mobile apps is usually the best approach because you just have two fewer things to worry about. It's like you have your web UI and that works on your native. And then maybe you show or hide some content that doesn't make sense on the native apps, like your, you know, hamburger menu or whatever, that doesn't make sense in a mobile context because you have a tab bar. But for the most part, you're just like rendering the same stuff styled the same way.
Yeah. So what's new? I mean, besides the name change, you know, what are we looking at here?
Yeah. So Turbo Native became Hotwire Native a few months ago. And the big change is that it now encompasses what used to be called Strata. Strata is, or was, the library formerly known as Strata, is the way to communicate to your web view through JavaScript. It's how you can add, it's kind of like stimulus for mobile apps. You add native sprinkles to your apps. You add a button in the top right or the top left. You add an interaction with the push notification API. And Strata worked with sending JSON back and forth between the native code and the web view, but it required like 150 lines of code to just integrate into your library because you had to subclass something and pass along messages. Now Strata is part of Hotwire Native and has just been renamed like Bridge Components, lowercase, you know, B, not a capital S for Strata. They're just a part of Hotwire Native now. And what that means is that when you use these Bridge Components, you just use them. You don't have to worry about like a whole installation step. They're already bundled. That's probably the biggest one. That's for probably not more experienced Hotwire Native developers, but more advanced apps. The most relevant change for people that have never used it is that the time to market, like from starting a new Hotwire Native iOS app to running it in the emulator or the simulator, went from 45 lines of code to like 12 lines of code to get something running. And Android went from, I think, like 70, 80 to like 25, 35. And those are the things that we're really looking forward to as making those even fewer, is just like how quickly can we get from brand new Xcode or Android Studio project to content rendering on the screen in a mobile simulator emulator. And we've made some really big progress with that by just making a lot of assumptions and letting people, you know, giving people some of the higher level abstractions than we used to give them with Turbo Native.
That makes sense. I have to say, there's this really terrific book out there. I don't know if you all have heard of it. It's called The Rails and Hotwire Codecs. And I was going through some steps in that for Turbo Native at the time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, a lot of this stuff that you're talking about, like the extra installation step, it wasn't impossible to figure out, but it wasn't something that I was regularly doing. And so it felt like it took an inordinate amount of time to figure things out when I messed them up. And yeah. So it sounds like there are just a lot fewer places where Chuck can mess it up, if that makes sense.
Yeah. The way I look at it, like Turbo Native, Hotwire Native is like equivalent on Rails to writing a route, adding a controller, and adding a view. Those are all wired up magically by their name, right? You have a posts controller, it's going to render posts/index or posts/show, depending on the method you're in. Turbo Native required you to manually say, okay, the get request to posts has to go to the posts index controller. And the posts index controller has to render the post index view. Like all of mm-hmm. those little places that you could either fat finger or just like miss. That's why we love Rails. All of those conventions yeah. make sense.
Conventional configuration. Yep.
Yeah. And like the Turbo Native was way more configuration over convention. And now Hotwire Native is way more convention over configuration. I hope I got those right. You do a lot less code with Hotwire right. Native, and a lot of it's just assumed for you. But we didn't hide any of the APIs. They're still public. Like if you still want to drop down and do all the wild stuff you were doing in a Turbo Native app, those APIs are still available to you. It's just like you're, you know, a layer below the abstraction we want you to work with. So you have more freedom, but you also are more responsible when something goes wrong.
Ayush, how does that make you feel with all the stuff you wrote in that book?
Honestly, it doesn't make too much of a difference to me because like it's a fast moving kind of uh-huh. area, and I knew that. And excuse me. And that was the reason why I decided for the second edition of my book, I wasn't gonna cover the native stuff anymore because I've got both my feet firmly in the web side of things, and it's quite a lot to do keeping up with all three platforms. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, not anymore. But I'm quite happy that these developments are happening because it makes life easier for other developers. Like when I was writing the native chapters in my book, it drove me to the edge of sanity. Like it was like, and I had done native development professionally before. It just had been a few years. So I was a bit rusty. Like for a beginner, I can imagine just how tricky that must have been. So I think removing all these hoops that you kind of have to jump through is definitely a step in the right direction. And really happy to hear that these changes are being made.
Yeah, so much of the old way of doing things was just like totally manual. Like, here's a link. What do you want to do with it? There was no routing in place. There was no modal handling. There was no dismissing. Like, mm-hmm. here's a link. Here's a web view. Like, go for it. It was so thin around the web view, the wrapper, mm-hmm. that, you know, your book, the Codex book, you had to deal with session delegates and like navigating between screens if there's a modal and stuff. And like all of that stuff has been abstracted into just one line where it's like, here's an object, give it a URL, and it will handle everything for you automatically as long as you have the path configuration set up, which we could dive into if you want. But that just didn't exist back then. And what's kind of wild is like it existed in Turbo Native Android for quite a while. But the iOS library just hadn't been updated in like a year to get up to speed with this. And when I first learned that, I was really upset because I was writing all this iOS code for so many clients. And then I was like, well, this is also just silly. Like, why have we not gotten up to speed? And that's around the time I started working with 37 Signals directly and started getting contracted by them to bring the iOS library up to speed with Android. That's where the Turbo Navigator library came from that we then upstreamed into Hotwire Native. Like all of this development that was essentially sponsored, right, by them that I could do to bring the two libraries back to feature parity. And I'm still working with them. Like, we have a really cool new demo site coming, which I'm very excited about. That's going to be written in Rails instead of JavaScript. So really relevant for Rails developers. But like, all of that stuff took buy-in from 37 Signals to finally sit down and say, okay, we're focusing on this now. And before that, it was just like, what is this Turbo Native thing? Is it even supported? You know, and I'm trying to scream from the mountaintops of, yes, it is. I have many, many clients running these apps, but it's hard when there's 30 open issues and the last commit was 6 months ago. It's not the case anymore.
Yeah. So speaking to that, right, speaking to kind of keeping things up to date and stuff like that, I will say that one of the things I ran into pretty fast was that, and I think I was working off an older version of Ayush's book, Codex book, but, and I'm looking forward to this in your book, because Pragmatic Programmers is usually pretty good, I will say, in making sure that what's in the book is pretty close to up to date. But I ran into version issues almost mm-hmm. right away.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's like, okay, do you want to run the latest Android? Okay. Well, you know, the example in this book is, you know, a version old or two versions old. And so I guess the question is, both for the book and for the framework,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, is a framework the right term for Hotwire Native? I'm going to say framework.
Yeah, framework. It's technically a library, right? But like, I call it a framework because we're building a Hotwire Native app.
Yeah. Anyway, so how well are they doing staying on top of those things, right? So when Apple releases a new iOS yeah. version or Android for sure. releases a new version, you know, yeah, is 37 Signals or whoever's working on it keeping that up to date? And then is your mm-hmm. book going to stay up to date?
Yeah. So right now we're in this interesting part where Android SDK 35 is like the default with new Android Studio builds.
Ranked number one in innovation 10 consecutive years, Arizona State University isn't just ahead of the curve. It's creating new paths to success. Learn from notable clinical and research faculty online. That's a degree better. Explore programs at asuonline.asu.edu. At Arizona State University, we're bringing world-class education from our globally acclaimed faculty to you. Ranked number one in innovation for 10 consecutive years and number two among public universities for employability, ASU isn't just ahead of the curve. It's creating new paths to success. Earn your degree from the nation's most innovative university. Online, that's a degree better. Explore more than 300 undergraduate, graduate, and certificate programs at asuonline.asu.edu.
But Hotwire Native Android works only with Android 34. So if you like create a new Android project right now, and you know this is February 20th, 2025, we're in the really that awkward time where the new live it became the default last week and we haven't upgraded
yet. Last week. Yeah. Okay.
Android changes like what? Like the SDK has been around for a while, but it became the new default in Android like very, very recently, right? So if you create a new Android app right now, it will be broken. You have to drop down to 34 and you're going to get all these warnings from Android Studio. So there's an open PR already for Hotwire Native Android. Right. We're just doing all our due diligence to make sure it works. But like things like that, we stay on top of them with the libraries. It's easy to release a new version of a library, relatively speaking. For the book, it gets a little bit trickier because I can't just update someone's physical copy of a book, right? I can update the PDF, no problem. Like the three beta versions of the book that have been out already.
That's why I always buy the digital version incidentally from Pragmatic Studio and not from Amazon. Is because they'll email me, hey, dude, there's a new one.
Exactly. Yeah, hey. You buy it direct from the publisher. You get an update every time I update it. And right now, we're in a really good spot with iOS. iOS just released a new version of Xcode that changes some things about how folders and groups are related under the hood. And like we're using that new stuff. So we're on up to speed there. But Android, the book is written for 34, not 35, because I have to wait till the Hotwire Native Android support comes out. So what I'm doing as an author is making sure that I'm not releasing this thing to physical until we are set on both platforms, at least for a little while. And that won't always be the case. Android 37 will probably break something when it comes out in a few years. But I see this book as something that will probably need to be updated every 18 months at a minimum. So I'm making sure that every single time I reference a version code or a version number or an SDK, it's like, by the way, this was tested on version X. If you're using anything newer, like, you're kind of at your own, but also join my Discord and I'll help you. Like, join my private Discord just for book readers, and I will help you get through it, because someone else is already going to ask that. We're already going to be up to speed on it. And maybe that just means like, hey, here's a PDF version of the book. You're good to go. Or it's like, oh, you need to just make this one change and it's like documented somewhere. Right. The short of it is that it sucks. like there's so many changes all the time. And I'm sometimes the one who's making the changes to the library. And then I know I have to update the book later. So I both have insider knowledge into what's coming next, but I also can dictate how quickly it happens or slowly. So it's also this just like fun mental game that I play with myself, where it's like, do we include this in the Hotwire native repos, but then my book has to mention it, or do we not? And like, I wait. So it's all this fun stuff I never really had to think about before.
Yeah, I feel your pain, man. It's when new stuff comes out in Rails, I'm always like agonizing. I'm still agonizing over what to do with the second edition, what to include, what to exclude. It's a lot harder when you're a book author as well, which actually segues nicely into another conversation I wanted to have, which is you historically were primarily an iOS developer. Am I right in saying that?
Mm-hmm.
And you did Android for this book as well. That, like, Android is fairly new to you for this book. What was that experience like? Because from my point of view, Android has been the bane of my life for years and years and years. Yeah. Like, everything on Android has been more difficult to do than iOS. Yeah. And I think for me, the final straw that made me decide to exclude native from the second edition was when Strada had just come out and I needed to update my book to include Strada. I was on holiday at my parents' house in India, and I opened up the Android repo for the book, and I included the Strada library in there. Instantly, everything broke. I fixed it. God knows how I fixed it. Still don't know how I fixed it, but I fixed it. Closed Android Studio, got back home to the UK, opened Android Studio again, and it was broken again.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, grr. Yeah. So, how was your experience like learning Android?
Yeah, I would say that I didn't really start learning Android until the Java to Kotlin migration, like change. Like, once Kotlin became the default language for Android apps and Android Studio, that was when I seriously started considering Android and started doing Android projects for clients. All of my public material, like my newsletter, my blog posts, my Twitter and everything, I usually talk about iOS because it's such a majority of the market, and the code is just way simpler most of the time. Like, there's way less code. It's like, you don't have to worry about some random XML file or some factory just to wire a little button up or whatever. So I usually talk about iOS because it's just more elegant and markets better. I've been doing Android for a long time, but I've never taught Android in the way that I'm teaching it in this book. So what I've had to do is I have a beta reviewer who is a like hardcore Android developer. Doesn't know Rails, doesn't know Hotwire native. They do Android day in and day out, and they are giving every single line of Android code like two or three read-throughs in this book. And that has pointed out some small things about like where I use a Ruby term instead of a Kotlin term, but also some larger things where like I've made mistakes in the book that are just straight up wrong. Like, I outlined a function and was like, here's how you'd write it in Kotlin. And he replied and was like, no, that doesn't even compile. It's like, oops, you know, like, thanks for that. But he's also bringing up more conventions that are more akin to the Android developer experience. Like, and you do things in Rails a certain way, you do things in iOS a certain way, you do things in Android a certain way. And I'm not as privy to those because I'm mostly just like slapping what I can together. He's coming out and saying, hey, you're managing your versions the wrong way. Like, you're essentially not adding any version numbers to your gem file. Like, you should probably have a version number in the equivalent for Android. Stuff like that, that's just like really helpful to pass on to my readers. It'd be really tough without that. And also just like the book would be worse because it'd be wrong in some places. And I'd look like an idiot. So very grateful for that editor, for that beta reviewer. It still doesn't change the fact that writing Android chapters usually takes me 2 to 3 times as long as writing the iOS chapters. I have a half a chapter left to finish my manuscript. All of the content, it'll still need to go over through 2 or 3 rounds of editing, but like the content, I have half a chapter left. It is an Android half a chapter. I have been writing this half a chapter for 3 weeks and it is killing me. And it's just like, I wrote the iOS chapter in like 2 hours, the iOS side of the chapter, but the Android side has been such a pain in the butt because I just like skip a step or forget something or get locked out of my Google Play account because I like said my name was Joseph Mazzalotti instead of Joseph Anthony Mazzalotti. And like little silly nitpicky things like that are causing this chapter to just take forever. But as soon as this call is done, I have a nice 3 hour chunk to work on it. And I'm hoping I can finish it.
It sounds like the old yarn for programmers where it's the first 90% of the work and then, you know, the second 90% of the work.
Oh my God, totally. And I know that as soon as I finish the manuscript, the real work starts of like the editor, get the first round development editor, the beta reviewers, then the publishing editor. And then we talk about typos and layout and it's like, and grammar, like we haven't even addressed those things yet, you know? And that's just going to be, I know, the most tedious, tiny changes, but they'll all make a better book. And that's why I'm working with a publisher.
Yeah. So, you know, kind of getting into this where you have a book, you know, you're walking people through building apps. I guess some of the questions that I have getting into kind of what you can and can't do with Hotwire Native, right? And I think we went into some of this in the other episode, but the biggest podcast that I do every week is JavaScript Jabber, right? Mm-hmm. And so you've got the React developers and the Vue developers, and then you've got other people that, you know, they're kind of into JavaScript, but they're not really like deeply, right? So they might have, instead of a single page app with React and React Router, they've got, you know, something that looks a little bit more like a Rails app, and they've got Express or Sales or something on the back end. Mm-hmm. And so my question is can you do a Hotwire Native app if it's not Rails?
Yeah, short answer is yes. The native frameworks, Hotwire Native, iOS and Android, are platform agnostic. They will work on any backend, any web rendered content, as long as you are doing your page-to-page navigation with Turbo.js. Okay. So if you're not doing Turbo.js, which is the default on new Rails apps, it has been for a number of years, you will not get the callback handlers to the native apps to know to present a new screen, to know to do the native transition, to give you the hooks to make changes.
Ranked number one in innovation 10 consecutive years, Arizona State University isn't just ahead of the curve. It's creating new paths to success. Learn from notable clinical and research faculty online. That's a degree better. Explore programs at asuonline.asu.edu. At Arizona State University, we're bringing world-class education from our globally acclaimed faculty to you. Ranked number one in innovation for 10 consecutive years and number two among public universities for employability, ASU isn't just ahead of the curve. It's creating new paths to success. Earn your degree from the nation's most innovative university. Online, that's a degree better. Explore more than 300 undergraduate, graduate, and certificate programs at asuonline.asu.edu.
So my recommendation is usually like, if you have Rails and you're using Hotwire, Hotwire Native is a very easy add-on to it. You don't have to make many changes to your server. If you have a React front end, and you have like a JSON, your Rails app is supplying a JSON endpoint type thing, you're going to have a much harder time kind of hammering that to make it work with Hotwire Native. And honestly, I'd just recommend React Native. But if you have a Vue app or even a Laravel app, if you change the page navigation to use Turbo.js, Hotwire Native will work as if it was a Rails app. And there's very little that you'll need to add to your non-Rails backend to get some of the niceties. Like you'll have to create your own Hotwire Native app helper that just checks the user agent. Like things like that that are actually not that hard or not that much code. But the most important thing is if it's running Turbo.js, you're good.
Right. So the other question that I have is, I know that some people have a tendency to, like, they'll run into some weird gotchas. I think my favorite one is that you have a form submit, mm-hmm. and a lot of times it'll submit with TurboStream. And then, you know, the way that you've put your page together, it doesn't actually reload anything. And so then people just turn it off. Mm-hmm. Does that make it not work with Turbo Native when you do that kind of a thing? Or are there other things that people may be doing with their Rails apps that are going to cause them trouble if they try and adopt this approach?
Yeah. So anything that's happening on the same page that, like, I use the example, is your URL changing? Mm-hmm. If your URL is changing, that will trigger most likely a new page, a new screen getting pushed on the native apps because you're doing like a full-on TurboJS navigation. If you're doing something where you have a turbo frame and that's making a request that's happening inside the turbo frame, that's not going to push a new screen onto the stack. And that's ideal. Like, you think about a lazy loaded frame, you don't want, when that frame loads, to push a new screen. You just want that content to appear inside the website. Turbo streams have their own custom handling, and there's some documentation about it on native.hotwire.dev. But the short of it is, like, if you're submitting a form, you'll most likely want to push a new page for the mobile apps because it will create a better experience for your mobile users. Mostly related to when you click a link, it opens a form in a modal. It slides in from the bottom to give you that context of, like, you've kind of broken out of the standard view. And then when you submit that form, it dismisses the modal and either refreshes the page underneath the original page you were on or pushes a new screen onto the stack. And all of that is handled now with the framework. You don't have to do anything custom except one line of configuration to say that these screens should be presented as modals. But the best part about all of that is, like, all of the caching of the previous screens, because you made a post or a non-get request, all of that caching is destroyed. So when you go back, that content will be fresh. If you go forward, that content will be new. You have all of this default sane handling around form submissions that didn't exist before that really makes it, like, most folks won't even know what I'm talking about because you never have to deal with it. And that's like the way we want it, you know?
Yep.
Do you want to talk briefly about I don't know if these are still a thing, but there are three pods which are drawn in Rails specific for Turbo, for Hotwire Native: receive historical location, resume historical location, and refresh historical location. I don't know if those are still a thing, and seems relevant. We could probably chat about that as well.
Yeah, for sure. So those are the historical location routes. And the Turbo Rails gem includes those by default. It's also what exposes the Hotwire Native question mark helper to essentially say, is this request coming from a Hotwire Native app, to do conditional logic. Those three routes were something that I didn't know about for a number of years. They've kind of flown under the radar. They kind of were shoved in Turbo Rails because Basecamp needed them, and they were never publicly exposed or documented. Ayush, you found those in your book. And when I was reading your book, the Codex book, I was like, wow, these are really powerful. But didn't really understand how to use them because you had to set up a lot of default handling around them. And there's an open PR right now. Hopefully by the time this podcast is released, it's merged in and a new version is released, where this handling will be automatically included in the native wrappers by default. And what that means is that at any point, you can redirect to one of these three special routes, and the Hotwire Native app will take custom actions: recede, refresh, resume. So recede will pop the top screen off the stack, kind of navigate backwards. If there's a modal presented, it will dismiss the modal. Refresh will do the same thing, but then refresh the previous page. And then resume essentially just says, like, don't do anything. I still haven't found a use case for that one. So if you're listening and know of one, I'd love to hear it. But these are really, really helpful when you're doing form submissions. Because, like, most of the time when you submit a form, you're, like, on the index page, you show the new page, and then you go back to the index page. You want that index page to refresh, to show the new entry or, like, the flash message or whatever. And you can use this refresh historical location to dismiss the screen and then refresh the one underneath. And your mobile apps behave as if it was a Rails app, just, like, perfectly. There's also some helpers built in that let you do these routes only for Hotwire native apps, but then do a normal redirect for rail for your web apps. So you actually don't even have to have any conditional logic. You can just use these helpers and pass in a new route, which make it even easier on your Rails server because there's less changes to manage. You're essentially changing that one line of code instead of, you know, an if-else statement.
Yeah, so, I found that the integration with the redirect helper is really, really useful because you could just do something like receipt or redirect to on exactly. the Rails side.
Yeah, exactly.
So I have another question that's not in this vein at all. One of the things that I see people talk about, you know, when they're talking about the different options, right? Usually it's in the JavaScript world. And so they're looking at like Ionic Capacitor kind of thing, which is sort of kind of in this vein and sort of kind of not in this vein. And then you've got the React Native, and then you've just got like straight up native where you're writing Swift or Kotlin.
Yeah.
And with the React Natives and the others, basically one of the things that people get into then is, well, what if my app has to be offline,
yeah.
right? What if I have to deliver content or stuff like that offline? Or, you know, I'm working in a place where there's not really good connection, but I need to use the app to, I don't know, upload pictures or crap like that, right? Mm-hmm. So it needs to cache it. And then when my Wi-Fi turns on, then it says, oh, here's all the activity I needed to do.
Yeah.
Is that just not a good fit for Turbo Native, or are there mechanisms that allow you to do some of these things?
Short answer is, if you need an offline first app, Hotwire Native is not a good choice.
Okay.
You're going to end up having to build out so much of the code base natively to do offline access first that it's not worth trying to kind of shove Hotwire Native into it. If you have an app, you know, kind of moving along the spectrum here, if you need an app that is mostly web connected but has like one or two offline features, snapping a photo and uploading it when you have Wi-Fi, you build a Hotwire Native app and you just build those features natively. So maybe 20% of your app is native, the rest of the 80% is driven by the web. That's a really good use case because you still get all the benefits of Hotwire Native, and then you have this little offline experience for a very specific use case. I did exactly this for a client last year, 2 years ago at this point, where they were a tour guide, like reseller. They sold tickets to tour guides, to tourists going on tours. And oftentimes they were traveling, so they didn't have Wi-Fi, right? Or internet at all. So they would open the Hotwire Native app. In the background, it would download all of their tickets. And then when they opened the app without service, it would switch into offline mode with some native code and show through a native screen all of the tickets that they have purchased that are stored on the device. Then when they click one of those, it would show the QR code and the map, all this stuff that they needed to get to the tour and then show the tour guide, hey, this is my ticket. But all of it was offline. All of it was cached to the device, and none of it was dealt with Turbo Native or Hotwire Native. It was all done with manual code. And then as soon as they got internet access again, it would switch to online mode where there was a link to the same experience on the web. That's like the really, I think, the best of both worlds, essentially, where you have this offline experience for a very important specific use case, and then everything else is powered by Hotwire Native. For complexity, the Hotwire Native implementation versus the native code, Hotwire Native was about 5%. Native implementation was about 95%. So like that's the level of, you know, native code you'll need just to build those two screens versus what you need for Hotwire Native to access your entire Rails server.
Right. So I have two use cases that I'm thinking of here. And one of them is kind of like that, where I've talked about, hey, I'm politically whatever. I'm not going to get into all that. But we have an issue where we have a caucus night in Utah every 2 years. And last year we tried to do a registration, and that was a web app. And then we wanted to be able to scan people's QR codes and check them in. Mm-hmm. And the Wi-Fi at the schools was not ideal.
Yeah.
And so what you're saying is we could have had the people who were scanning QR codes, right? The QR code scanner and having a list of people who have already registered, having that could be a native component, but the rest of it's all Turbo Native. And then the same thing with people showing up with a QR code. The other use case that I'm looking at is a little different, and that is for top-end devs.
Mm-hmm.
And incidentally, I made it into a multi-tenant app. So if you wanted to run your podcast network on what I'm running, you know, I want to open that up to people and I want them to have an app.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But one thing that I've seen is if you're putting out videos or other content, yeah, some people want to access that offline.
Right.
And what I've seen from other apps is you kind of hit the button and then it says, okay, I'm downloading it. And then once it's downloaded, it just kind of has a flag on it that says, this is available offline. And so what you're saying is I could just have it then load a native player and play the video, or a yeah. native player for the audio. And then the rest of the app, so browsing and knowing what you have access to and everything else, I can either cache those pages or I can, yeah, things like that. Just let that run as a regular app.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And offline caching is like a whole nother topic that is not supported right now, but is supported in like Basecamp and Hey, if you notice that. So that is something that, like, maybe there's opportunity to upstream that. Maybe there's opportunity for 37 Signals to get like a public, here's how you could enable caching. There's been some open PRs that have been closed over the last year or so that just, like, it wasn't right for public use, but I wouldn't be surprised if there is something like that in the future for Hotwire Native, where if you've visited a page and then you try to access that same page without internet access, like, you get a cached version.
Right. Well, the other thing that I can see is, and I've seen this in other apps, and you can do this with PWAs, you should be able to do it with Turbo Native, is you've got the offline storage kind of thing. And so you just cram the state up into the offline storage. And then when they browse, yeah, it checks to see if you have access to the internet. And if it doesn't, then it just loads the data off of what's held in memory, essentially.
Yeah, browser. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so that was actually going to be my next question, is how do you feel about using like service workers for offline access?
Yeah, service workers are something that I have very little experience with, so I can't comment on anything like firsthand, but I do know that
it adds a servers workers JS in Rails 8, so I'm assuming they're planning on giving you access to that kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. So like PWA stuff without Hotwire Native removed is already on a great path with Rails 8. The Android side has actually a better story here. Service workers work better in an embedded web view. Right now, there's this issue with WK web view, which is the web view that powers the iOS apps, and PWA-like features don't exactly work in the way that they work on the web in like Safari.app. So to make those work well, like with service workers and, you know, offline storage and background processing and all that stuff, like, we have to do something either to Hotwire Native, or it won't be possible because of WK web view until they update that. And it's usually a security thing, because you're just like injecting JavaScript and stuff into it. But from the literature that I've read around this, like, WK web view is actually the biggest blocker on PWA-like features in an embedded web app.
Ranked number one in innovation 10 consecutive years, Arizona State University isn't just ahead of the curve. It's creating new paths to success. Learn from notable clinical and research faculty online. That's a degree better. Explore programs at asuonline.asu.edu. At Arizona State University, we're bringing world-class education from our globally acclaimed faculty to you. Ranked number one in innovation for 10 consecutive years and number two among public universities for employability, ASU isn't just ahead of the curve, it's creating new paths to success. Earn your degree from the nation's most innovative university. Online, that's a degree better. Explore more than 300 undergraduate, graduate, and certificate programs at asuonline.asu.edu.
And that's not that wouldn't be a Hotwire Native limitation. That's like an embedded web browser limitation.
Yeah, JavaScript Jabber, we did an episode where it was mostly Dan, but he basically just ripped into Safari. because there are a lot of features that make web-enabled apps better, cleaner, easier to run that Safari just doesn't implement. And where it causes issues on their end, on the JavaScript end, is that, yes, you can get Chrome or Brave for your iPhone, and it's basically a dressed up version of Safari, and so you have the same issues. And this is not an isolated issue, and there are people outside of the Rails community that are working on workarounds for a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, not specific to Hotwire Native, just Safari, even though it's my browser of choice, is a kind of a pain in the butt.
Yep, you can say
that. Wow, you're the only person I've ever heard say that.
I kind of want to go back to something we touched on at the start of the talk, and that's like more about the process of writing a book. I know, if I remember correctly from your social media, you weren't sure whether you wanted to self-publish or go with a publisher. And eventually you did go with a publisher, and I've personally self-published. So I just wanted to compare notes. Mm-hmm. What made you go with a publisher? What have you liked? What have you not liked?
Yeah. There's two big, one big reason for going for a publisher and one big reason against self-publishing, which both led me towards using a publisher. The big reason against self-publishing is that going self-published, the benefit is getting 100% royalties or 90x% royalties, right? Like, you make more money per sale. My goal was not to make money off of this book directly. My goal is to get clients and exposure and, you know, solidify myself as the expert in the space. Having another couple of thousands of dollars, maybe tens of thousands of dollars if I got really lucky by self-publishing, was not like worth it compared to what I could be making off of a couple of clients. So the benefits of self-publishing were like not really benefits at all. The benefits of having a publisher were having an editor I didn't have to hire, having someone keep me to a timeline, someone making sure that the last 80% after I finish the first 80% actually gets done, you know, things like that, and having someone to review cover art with, having a team of beta reviewers that are platform specific that can help me with stuff, having a distribution network, talking to my local bookstore to make sure my book is on the shelves there instead of having to like walk in and be like, hey, can you stock this for me? Like, the lists of going with a publisher, of any publisher, were just aligned so well to my goals of the book that self-publishing like didn't stand a chance once I finally understood that was my goals, that those were my goals. At the beginning, I didn't really get that. I was like, I want to write a book and I want full control over it. So I was leaning for it towards self-publishing. I want to make sure that the margins are exactly what I want. The codes looks like this, the cover looks like that. But those things didn't really matter because of all the extra work I would have had to have done going self-publishing.
Yeah, man, self-publishing is hard work. Just to kind of give our listeners the other side of the coin, because I decided to self-publish and I obviously went through the same kind of decision process. And marketing myself as a freelancer was a huge part of why I wrote my book as well. But for me, the kind of clincher was creative control. I wanted 100% creative control, top to bottom, from everything to do with the cover art, to the font size, to content, to silly jokes that I had in the text. Like, I end the book with a Klingon word. It's like just silly, silly, stupid things like that. And I didn't want anybody over my shoulder telling me, oh, we can't do that, or you can't do that. So for me, that was the clincher. It came with a hell of a lot of additional work. Like, and another thing I think what kind of pushed me towards self-publishing is I knew it was going to be ebook only. The way I've written the book, for anyone who's read it, knows it's full of hyperlinks to stuff. It has links to other parts of the book. It has links out to the internet. It was never written to be a print book, and I knew that from day one.
Yeah.
So what with an ebook only distribution model, as like, and the fact that I wanted creative control, I was like, yeah, I'll just stick it on Gumroad and be done with it.
Yeah.
But obviously it comes with a lot more hard work in terms of marketing and self-editing and stuff like that. So yeah, this is, I just wanted to give the listeners a bit of contrast because there's no right answer to this. And Joe and I had different goals, and I think we both found the right path for us. And if you're thinking of writing a book, don't just take someone else's answer.
Yeah, I think that if your goal is to just like get something out as quickly as possible, also, like, you have to self-publish. It's going to take me almost to the month, 2 years from the time I started writing this to the time it will be a physical, you know, I can hold it in my hands, done with the printing press. Like, that's a really long time. And I mean, it actually worked out for me because during those 2 years, Turbo Native became Hotwire Native. Like, I would have self-published a book for Turbo Native and then had to like redo the book entirely for Hotwire Native. So I'm glad that it took longer because I was able to do that during the editing process, not during the like post-publish process. But if you want to get something out, like, you have something to say that you need to get out in the next couple of months, like, you can't go with a publisher, most likely. It's going to be way too long. It's going to take that long to find a publisher.
Yeah, a couple of other things I want to just push in here. So the book I wrote, it was on building your career and finding your next job. And to be honest, I mean, at this point, I would go back and I would add a whole bunch of stuff about using AI to understand your resume and line it up with the job postings and things like that. And, you know, there was a bunch of other stuff in there about building your personal brand that is a separate book. Mm-hmm. I didn't really understand what the goal was. I thought for sure that I would just put the book out there and a whole bunch of people would buy it.
Yeah.
And so my experience having done that now is, yeah, if I were going to write a full-on book or manual or, you know, something that, you know, you kind of think of as that technical book you put on your shelf,
yeah,
I would 100% go talk to the folks over at Pragmatic Bookshelf. I mean, I might shop it to Manning. Manning's royalties are higher than like Pearson and and them. I've got a pretty good relationship with them as well. But, I'd probably go with one of the two and use a lot of their distribution network. One thing you have to understand, though, is no matter who you go with, most of the marketing and sale of your book is going to be down to you and what you can do to go get the word out, right? Totally. So you're going to be doing what Joe's doing, coming on a show like this and, you know, and maybe, you know, publishing stuff to YouTube or a blog or places like that and making sure that people can find it. And you have to do that with self-published too. The difference is that the book publisher will, you know, they'll provide you an editor and a lot of those other things. And in some cases, like Manning has reached out to me many, many times for their authors. And so, you know, they may help you figure out some of that marketing. One thing that I'm going to kind of back up on a little bit is I've talked to a number of friends who have released like shorter versions of things, right? So, you know, it's like a 30-page book on, hey, here's just how you get the thing to run, right? You know, so instead of building a car, you know, or building the frame of the car with Turbo or with Hotwire Native, right, it's just basically a bare bones, here's how you get Turbo running in your app in, you know, in 30 pages. And typically the publishers aren't so interested in those. Usually if you're trying to build your reputation on something like that too, like you can crank one of those every month and you can build some reputation for putting stuff out. And so again, there are a lot of approaches you can take, but yeah, if it, and I think even if you're doing kind of the short content or if you're doing podcasts like this or something like that, like having that full length technical book on something that, you know, like Joe saying that he can go find clients for and build business for it, it really will pay off for you. But then you can do the other things to kind of, you know, build your reputation and then go back to that. And the fact that you went through a publisher that helped you make it the best thing possible is actually a good thing overall for your reputation. And so if I were to go back and write my book again,
Ranked number one in innovation 10 consecutive years, Arizona State University isn't just ahead of the curve. It's creating new paths to success. Learn from notable clinical and research faculty. Online, that's a degree better. Explore programs at asuonline.asu.edu.
If your job at a healthcare facility includes disinfecting against viruses, you know prevention is the best medicine. And maintaining healthy spaces starts with a healthy cleaning routine. Grainger's world-class supply chain helps ensure you have the quality products you need when you need them. From disinfectants and cleaning supplies to personal protective equipment, so you can help deliver a clean bill of health. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I would have gone to Prague, Prague, and I would have, or, you know, and I would have said, hey, look, guys, this is the book I want to write. Yeah. Here's kind of an outline. They might have given me some other ideas. We don't know if we could sell it, or, hey, you haven't covered this, or if you change the direction of this a little bit, we think it's a better fit for the market, which is all healthy. And then they would have helped me get the book out and had it be the best thing possible.
Yeah, I think that last point is something that I haven't spoken about, so it might be interesting to cover here. One of the first things that I talked with Pragmatic about was the structure of my book. I went in wanting to do two books, an iOS book and an Android book. That was like my original pitch. I was like, I can knock out the iOS book in a couple weeks in terms of writing. The Android book's going to take me a couple months. And if someone wants both, they'll buy both and there'll be like some duplicated content on the Rails server. And I could have easily filled 250 pages for each and gone much more deeper with both. And
I can tell you, I want one book.
Exactly. That's exactly where we ended up. Like questions being asked of me of like, well, what does the audience want to read? Is 90% of the audience doing iOS and never touching Android? Okay, well then Android goes second. Like all of these little decisions that I would have either hemmed and hawed over for months and just never made a decision on, or made a just less educated decision. What I wanted to do as a second pass was like section one was all iOS and then section two was all Android, and you would build the full iOS app and then build the full Android app. And that kind of makes sense to how you're building it. You know, you're less likely to build both at the same time, but when you're learning, it's actually better to learn and build both at the same time because you can learn and compare and contrast the two frameworks and the two platforms. So every chapter is like Rails, then iOS, then Android. And that little change in the structure of the book from my editor has made the book so much easier to read and understand. And things like that, I just can't imagine having to have full control over and doing it on my own. And there's probably countless other ones that I don't even remember because we've made, you know, we talk every couple of weeks on like how the direction and making sure that we're aligned with the goals of the book and the audience of the book and stuff like that, that I would have gotten way distracted by now and probably just pushed whatever I had and called it done and not been happy with it.
Yeah.
Could you talk about a little bit about the process of finding a publisher, what it entailed?
Yeah. A lot of my looking for a publisher phase was actually, do I want to self-publish or go with a publisher? So most of my research was spent talking to folks who had self-published or folks who had gone with a publisher, you know, in casual calls. I think I spoke to like 10 people, either through a Zoom call or like a Twitter conversation or email. And once I had spoken to everyone that had self-published or gone through a publisher, I was like, okay, I'm not deciding between self-publishing and publisher. I'm deciding between self-publishing and Prague. Like that was the option. Uh-huh. It was so clear that Prague was the best fit for me from talking to folks about my writing style, about what they valued, about how they manage code, about how they do promotions. Royalties was great. It was kind of just icing on the cake. How they gave me an editor and beta reviewers and all this stough. Like it was never, is it Prague or O'Reilly or whatever. It was like self-publish or go with Prague. So once I got to that, the decision was actually pretty easy once I decided my goal of getting more clients. Okay, Prague.
Yeah.
So did you just like send them an email and that was it? Like
I ended up sending an email to Prague. I submitted an official pitch to O'Reilly, and I submitted an official pitch to one more publisher that I can't recall the name of. The third one that I can't remember the name of never got back to me at all. And O'Reilly said that they aren't looking for such a like cross-platform book right now. It didn't fit in with their strategy. They were like, if you want to do just an iOS app or just a Rails app, like we would definitely like to talk more. But this weird cross-platform thing is not what we're looking for right now. And Prag got back to me within like 24 hours and was like, let's go. So that was pretty awesome. Promising. I was talking to Dave within like a week, the you know person who owns and runs Prag, and was just like, yes, this is great. We're really excited about this. Let's get
set up. He's a riot to talk to. He is so funny.
He's awesome. I just did an interview with him like 2 weeks ago, and it just got published this week. We chatted for like an hour, and we cut it down to 20 minutes of just like what the book's about, what Hotwire Native is, and he is such a delight to talk to. And seeing those little clips of him asking like, you know, these naive questions is so much fun.
Yeah, I think the other thing you have to, because I think some people are probably going to be thinking, oh, well, you know, O'Reilly or, you know, Pearson owns O'Reilly, but, you know, they just don't get it. That may not be the case. They know the audience they're trying to sell to.
Yeah.
And so does Prag, right?
Yeah.
And so Pragmatic Bookshelf, I mean, they know they have Pickaxe, they've got, you know, agile web development with Rails or whatever it's called. Mm-hmm. You know, they have a handful of books in that space. And so they know that they are already in front of people who will buy this book.
Exactly.
And yeah. And so, you know, I don't want anyone to be thinking, oh, well, you know, they blew it over there. They're selling to a different audience. It's the same with Manning or Pact or any of the other ones that you went.
Yeah, Pact. That was the one I reached out to. Pact.
So, yeah.
I mean, my book's came out like officially about a month, beginning of January, like January 6th or 9th or something. And it's been in the bestseller list since then. It hasn't dropped out. So like there's clearly something aligned with their audience and my book content, which is awesome to see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they do a good job too. Like, if it's coming out, you know, because you said you haven't quite finished it, yeah, you buy it now, you get a good deal on it for one, and then you get the finished product anyway. Mm-hmm, and so, if you want to get started and get, you know, 95.9% of the way down the road, and then you get that last piece that Joe's working on, it works out pretty well.
Yeah, it works out pretty well. And like, you just get it early. You're going to get the rest of the content eventually. You just get it early and for cheaper. You do have to deal with a terrible layout, though, because code snippets are smushed across multiple pages because the layout editor hasn't gotten in there. So if you can deal with that, it's a pretty good trade-off.
Yeah. So a couple of things that I'm just going to throw out there as well. So with Ruby Geniuses, we're doing a book club every month. For March, we're doing a book on prompt engineering because a lot of people want to learn AI. But I've already decided that in April and May, we're doing the Hotwire Native book by Joe. And then we're also going to do the Rails and Hotwire Codecs because a lot of people are kind of looking for that front to back, soup to nuts. How do I build this thing the best way possible? And what I find with a lot of these books is it's not that I couldn't go figure it out on my own, right? I'm a smart guy. I go figure it out on my own. But the difference is that you've gone through and thought through enough of the use cases that I'm going to run into an issue and go, oh, what do I do here? And then it turns out it's in your book.
Yeah.
That's why I like the books is because you steer me off of the track so that I'm not heading into an oncoming train that I didn't even know was out there.
Yeah. A lot of my book, I think at least once a chapter, you'll do something and you'll get a, you know, air quotes, unexpected result. That's how I've seen developers try to build Hotwire Native apps. And, you know, during the tab, when you build tabs, the first time you launch the app, the app is just a completely white screen. And I have a screenshot of that, you know, and I'm like, well, what the hell just happened? And you realize that you like forgot one line of code that almost every developer misses when they build tabs. Mm-hmm. And we walk through that together. So you know that not only did you learn that one line, but you will never make that mistake again because you saw the problem of the blank screen and then you fixed it yourself. And I have one of those at least in every single chapter that adds a lot of content, of course, but I just really love it because it really enforces the learning, not just the copy pasting from the book of code. It's like you're learning how this works.
Yeah, I used to do that when I did the Teach Me to Code screencasts. Mm-hmm. I'd leave the mistakes in. Like I would cut the Googling the solution out, but I'd have people ask me all the time, why'd you leave the mistake in? And I was like, well, I talked to people after they watched my videos and I asked them if they ran into the same mistake. And like half the people.
Ranked number one in innovation 10 consecutive years, Arizona State University isn't just ahead of the curve. It's creating new paths to success. Learn from notable clinical and research faculty online. That's a degree better. Explore programs at asuonline.asu.edu.
They follow along as I go and they make the same mistake I do, right? And then they fix it when I come back with the fix.
Yeah.
And the reason is because it's a common thing. It's a real easy thing to do. And so, yeah, I like that. I really like that.
You mentioned briefly just like the layout's a bit iffy and stuff right now. So another huge challenge which you'll have if you're self-publishing is literally just producing a PDF and an EPUB. Like, it is stupid hard to just convert something you've written into a PDF and EPUB. And I was surprised at just how difficult it was. So when you work with a publisher, is that something do they give you some tools to make life easier with that?
Yeah, Prag has its own markup language. And it's like proprietary, you know, under NDA, all of this awesome stuff. And it handles just, I write one file and it then can output to PDF, to Mobi, to EPUB, to physical copy. Like it does all of these amazing things with its own markup language that I don't have to worry about. Like, should this be a link on mobile, but actually a page number on a physical book? Like it's all handled for you. And then I can just write like in one file and images, of course, and my code, write it all in one file. And then when the layout editor gets in there, they can add their own special markup that I don't even like know or care about. That's going to make sure that we don't have orphans or ants, whatever the opposite of an orphan is, or code snippets spanning across two pages or images that are too small or too big. Like all that's just going to be handled by the layout editors. And I can just worry about writing really good content. And that's a huge weight off my shoulders because that's something I do have to worry about when I do like my newsletter or my blog posts. It's like that whole last 30% is just spent doing producing. I can just skip all that with the publisher and just write.
Yeah, that sounds like a huge case for a publisher.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one thing that Ayush brought up was the content ownership.
Mm-hmm.
So who has rights to your book?
Yeah, Prag has rights to my book. They have rights to the content in the book. And I am able to repurpose that content if I want to. So I've been thinking about doing like a course that would be very similar to the content of that book, but I can't reproduce like the whole content and sell it or publish it on my blog or anything. There's also exceptions to that. Like if I want to sneak peek a chapter or two, I can get permission and republish it word for word. And as long as I outline that it's from the book, that's totally fine. The thing that didn't bother me about that is that like a lot of the content from my book exists in the wild already. You'd have to piece together every one of my newsletters, every single one of my blog posts, every single
one
of my
tweets.
That's why
you buy the book. Because you don't want to do that.
Yeah, like my private Discord server where I'm answering people's questions, GitHub issues, discourse discussions. Like if you pieced all of that together, you'd have 50%+ of the content of the book, right? Mm-hmm. But it'd all be disparate and it wouldn't be connected to the same app that you're building. Like it'd all just be like spread across in code snippets. So them owning the content of my book seemed less I'm less worried about it because I know that I can recreate this in my own different, like not my own voice, but for my own platforms when it makes sense. When I, a whole chapter is on tabs. If I write tabs on my blog, I'm not going to use the same techniques that I wrote about in the book. Sorry, I'm going to use the same techniques I'm going to write about in the book, but it's not going to be the same content. By the time you get to tabs in the book, you already have an app that does a bunch of stuff and we're just adding stuff on top. If I write that for my blog, it's like, okay, new Xcode project, new Android Studio project, here's how to add tabs. And that is a totally different piece of content, even if I'm teaching the same concepts and, like, you know, approach, because of the audience and the context that's built into that.
Awesome. Well, we're at about an hour and 10 minutes. I think we've pretty well covered this too. It seems like there's a lot there. Definitely an option worth looking at if you're looking at putting a mobile app on your Rails app and you're not super keen to, oh, now I have to add an API and I have to authenticate the API and then I have to turn around and write an app that consumes the API and I've got to build new interfaces and blah, 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 blah. So if people want to get the book, is there a link people can follow? You said there was a discount. Is that discount just built in or is there a coupon code? Do you want to tell us about that?
We will put the coupon code in the show notes because there is one. I cannot remember it right now. But you can get the book at, if you go to my website, mazzalotti.com, there's a big banner up at the top that links to the purchase page on the publisher's website, which is the best way to buy it because, as Chuck mentioned earlier, you'll get an email from them on any update through the beta every 2 weeks. And then also once the book is published, any errata that gets changed, you'll get an email saying like, hey, these are all the changes. And a new version of that PDF or Mobi or EPUB for your readers.
Yeah. And then I'm also just going to put this out there. I have an email list for the show and I have two codes to give away free copies of the book. And so if you want a copy of the book for free, and I'm sure Pragmatic Bookshelf's great. So if you buy it and then you win a copy, they'll figure it out with you. I say that confidently without any authority to make promises for them because they've just been so great with everything that I've ever done with them. But yeah, so if you go to rubyrogues.com, I'm adding in the email form literally this week. So by the time this is published, you'll be able to join the email list. Right now, the email list has like 130 people on it. So you have a decent chance of getting the book. I took my old list and I segmented it. I just sent an email out and said, if you want to be on the Ruby only list, that's why there are only 130 people on it. But anyway, if you want that, I mean, I'm going to be sending out content on doing whatever it is that we're covering in, you know, in the membership. But and then, you know, dropping hints and tips and stuff like that. There'll be a bunch of good content. But besides that, if you're on the list, I'm going to let it run through the end of, I guess it's February now. So we'll let it run through the end of March. And then whoever's on the list, I'll take that list. I'll drop it into some random picker and we'll give away two copies. So, if you're interested, yeah, go to rubyrogues.com and just join the email list. And, yeah, I look forward to hearing from you there as well.
Yeah, and the discount code is Ruby Rogues Hotwire. We'll get you that 35% discount from the Pragmatic Bookshelf website.
Awesome. All right. Well, let's go ahead and do some picks, and then we'll go ahead and wrap up. Ayush, do you have some picks for us?
Yeah, I was actually thinking of them during the show because I didn't think of any before. A couple of non-technical picks again. I always try to do a music pick, so I'm going to continue with a music pick, and there's an album that I used to, that I loved when it came out in 2019 and kind of fell by the wayside until I discovered it again a couple of weeks ago. And I was like, bloody hell, I forgot how amazing this album is. It's called Empath by Devin Townsend. It's a metal album, but it kind of transcends genre, really. It's like, it's predominantly metal, but there's a whole lot of other kind of styles on there as well. And I think that's what makes it interesting for me because I'm not really that much of a metal fan, but I absolutely love that record. So Yeah, check that out. Empath by Devin Townsend came out in 2019. And I'm rewatching a TV show at the moment, which is one of my favorite TV shows called The Good Place. And yeah, I love it. I'm just doing a rewatch because I'm bored. So since I can't think of anything else, I'll choose that as one of my picks. Yeah, that's all I've got today.
If you're bored, I've got plenty of stuff that you can do for me.
Yeah, when I say bored, I also mean lazy and can't be bothered to do the actual stuff I should be doing.
Nice. Oh, okay. Never mind then. I'm going to jump in with some picks. My first pick, I always do a board game. I don't think I picked this last week, but I'm picking Groundhog Day, the game. Now, Groundhog Day is a movie that came out in, what, 90 something? 96? I don't know. I'm totally guessing. Anyway, funny movie, Bill Murray, classic movie. And I feel no compunctions whatsoever in putting out spoilers because the movie is so freaking old.
It came out in 93.
Ranked number one in innovation 10 consecutive years, Arizona State University isn't just ahead of the curve. It's creating new paths to success. Learn from notable clinical and research faculty online. That's a degree better. Explore programs at asuonline.asu.edu.
93, even better, right? It's more than 30 years old. So anyway, in the game, he goes through and relives the same day over and over and over again until he has kind of the perfect day. Right. You know, he gets the girl, he, you know, all the things. Right. And so Groundhog Day, the game, is the same premise. And so you have a perfect day. If you play all seven cards in a day as red cards. Right. And the red cards are four heart cards. If you do that, you win. The way you play on each day is you can play any number higher than the last number played. And then day to day, your days have to get better, right? So there are gray cards that have no hearts. There are blue cards that have one heart. There are orange cards that have two hearts, and there are yellow cards that have three hearts. And some of the yellow cards get more red cards into the deck. So when you pass them around to everybody, it's a cooperative game. Anybody can jump in at any time and play a number. So on your first day, you're usually playing the gray and blue cards because they're lower hearts. And so maybe you get a day that has four hearts. So the next day, you know, you take the rest of the cards, you shuffle them, and you pass them out again. And all of those lower value cards are gone. So now you maybe have a five heart or six heart day. If you get too far ahead of yourself, right, because it has to go up. So if you can't play on the day and you need more cards in the day, you lose. And then if you don't ever get a day full of red cards, you lose. It's a pretty simple game. Board Game Geek says it's a 1.22 weight. Two is like complex-ish games. So, I mean, this is one. I think we were playing around in like 15 minutes with five of us. Anyway, it's really fun because you literally just pass out the cards, fill up the day, shuffle the cards, pass them out again, right? And you get fewer cards every round is the other thing that comes in. So our strategy was at the point where, you know, somebody has a couple of red cards and one of them's reasonably low, and you think they're good odds that there are seven, eight cards in the stack in other people's hands, right? Because you don't deal out all the cards, then you go for it. So anyway, fun game, really enjoyed it. And so I'm going to pick that. In the show notes, there will be a link to Board Game Geek where you can kind of check out what other people have thought. And then there's going to be an Amazon affiliate link so that you can go check it out. A couple of other picks here. If you're watching the video, you can see I have a little bit of a split lip. So we have cold, dry winters here in Utah, and that's just the way it goes. So I'm going to pick Chapstick just because it's made my life better the last few days. There was something else I was going to pick, and I just can't think of it. But anyway, I guess I'll just throw out Ruby Geniuses real quick. We're doing calls every week. I'm doing all the calls in March, and then I'm starting to bring in experts in April and May, probably for 2 or 3 out of the 4 or 5 weeks. So we'll get people like Joe or an Ayush and, you know, some of our other guests. I'm probably going to ask the guests from the show to just come on and, you know, we can hear what they're working on and they can kind of help us figure out how to do what they're working on and whatever we're working on. I'm getting way into AI. And so there are going to be some videos as well in the system for AI, just everything from here's how you just kind of get started with the fundamentals, either with a ChatGPT that you don't have to set up or Ollama and some of the other tools that are out there. That was what I was going to pick, but I don't have the link in front of me, so I'll pick it next week. But there's a web interface that sits on top of Ollama that you can just basically run it like ChatGPT, except you're not paying for it. And it's slightly less capable because ChatGPT will go search the web for information, and this really doesn't do that. But anyway, good stuff. Yeah, so those are my picks. Joe, what are your picks?
I have 2 picks, a book and also a board game. The book is Beautyland. I read it. I just finished it a few nights ago. It is the tale of a girl who grows up in Philadelphia and has kind of a troubled childhood, and she gets a fax machine and she starts faxing and slowly finds out that she's an alien living in Philadelphia. And she communicates to her home planet through this fax machine. And it's told in really digestible, like 2-3 paragraph chapters of her life experiences of her growing up from living in Philly to like going through high school, getting a job, having friends along the way. And it gives this really unique point of view of how aliens look at our life as humans. And there's a really awesome chapter on New York City, where I used to live, that's very nostalgic, but also just like very ironic and really makes you think about some of the things that we value. And like bagels are a big part of it. It's really, really good and a pretty quick read as well. And scratches that sci-fi itch that I really love. My board game is in the background right here, Slay the Spire. It is a board game based off of a video game based off of a board game. So the video game is called Slay the Spire, and it's essentially you play a board game of a roguelite deck builder. So you're like, you know, you're buying cards, playing them against the computer and like trying to build the optimal deck. The board game is exactly that as a board game. I think the only thing that changes are some of the scaling of the numbers. But like, if you've played the video game, it is an awesome board game to play because it plays really well solo. It's one of the few games that I think is like better played on your own against the game than playing with other people cooperatively. So I really love it because in the evenings when I'm wiped and want to just watch TV, I can set up a board game and play around by myself and not like sit in front of a screen for an hour before I go to bed. And it's really challenging. It's not too hard to learn if you already know the video game. It just does take a little bit while to set up physically, but definitely recommend that. It's a lot of fun.
So I'm just going to ask a couple of questions, because one thing that I've run into is I've bought games that have the solo player mode, and it's totally different from the regular game. And it's usually not as good. So yeah. How close does the solo game align with the multiplayer?
It's the exact same game solo. And then when you play with multiplayer, it adds 2 rules. So it's actually meant for solo play. And then multiplayer is like a mode almost that lets you play cooperatively. So all of the rules, nice. Everything is meant to be played solo, with a few exceptions.
Yeah. Board Game Geek has this one at a weight of 2.93.
Yeah, makes sense.
Says it can take anywhere from 30 to 150 minutes. It says age 12 plus, so it sounds like it's a little involved, but probably isn't terribly hard to pick up, is generally how I would read that.
It's easy-ish to play. It's really hard to master. So like learning the rules is reading a couple cards and knowing when damage happens and not. Being good at it and actually beating one of the 4 levels requires a few playthroughs.
Okay. It looks like fun though.
It's a lot of fun. I backed the Kickstarter version, so I have like metal coins and a little pouch and stuff for it. It's like,
oh,
it's
yeah,
like
that's always big. Fun.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, I'll buy a game at the game store or on Amazon, and then I'll play it with my friend. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the same game will have all these nice little pieces in it. And I'm like, did you make these or something? No, it's a Kickstarter version.
Yep, yep.
Yeah, Board Game Life. Yeah, that one came out in 2024. That's probably part of the reason why I haven't played it yet.
It's a good one.
Yeah. I did come up with the other thing. I'm just going to throw it out real quick. It's Open Web UI. And it's really easy to run on top of Ollama. So you install Ollama, you tell it which model you want to run. If you've heard about DeepSeek, that one made a splash. You can run DeepSeek versions. You can get the uncensored version of DeepSeek. It's fun to ask it about like Tiananmen Square and stuff, because the data they trained it on, it doesn't know anything about anything that China censors, right? but any it's a decent model. It runs fast and it's pretty good. So yeah, but it's open web UI, and so yeah, you can just run that on your local machine. I had somebody ask if you can do Cursor on it, and Cursor does other things too, so you really can't. But yeah. All right, Joe, if people want to find you on the internet, where do they find you?
Easiest spot is my website, maselati.com. I got links to all the socials there, my newsletter, my blog posts, and also the book.
All right. Well, one more time, that code, if you want 20% off, is Ruby Rogues Hotwire.
That's correct.
And you just go find it on the Pragmatic Bookshelf. It's pragprog.com. Mm-hmm. And yeah. All right, folks, we'll wrap it up here. Until next time, Max out.
Ranked number one in innovation 10 consecutive years, Arizona State University isn't just ahead of the curve. It's creating new paths to success. Learn from notable clinical and research faculty online. That's a degree better. Explore programs at asuonline.asu.edu.